This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Samantha Donovan. This Thursday, a special prosecutor to investigate allegations of war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan. And Beijing's war on Australia's exports doesn't seem to be dampening Chinese demand for our products. So why the disconnect between official policy and what consumers seem to want?
Really what's driving that is growing concerns around product safety and counterfeit items. So in China has really reduced trust in Chinese products amongst the local market.
First today, the nation will have to deal with some brutal truths. The Prime Minister has just announced an initial response to the investigation into allegations of war crimes by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan. Anna Henderson joins me now from Parliament House in Canberra. Anna, what more can you tell us about what the Prime Minister has announced?
Well, Sam, we know now through the Prime Minister that a special investigator will be appointed to prosecute these allegations of Australian war crimes in Afghanistan. The government is still preparing to release the long-awaited report that was conducted into the conduct of special forces. But we now know there will be this special new role, and as well as that, a panel to drive cultural change inside Australia's Special Air Service Regiment and 2nd Commando Regiment. This has been a long investigation. It started in 2016. It relates to allegations which date back over about a decade. The Inspector General of the Australian Defence Force has been examining these allegations of unlawful killings and other possible breaches of the law by elite soldiers during that lengthy conflict in Afghanistan. The Prime Minister today did say that this is going to be a very tough report once it is formally released. Let's hear from him now.
It is our Australian way to deal with these issues with a deep respect for justice and the rule of law, but also one that seeks to illuminate the truth, but also seek to understand it, because that is what must drive our response.
Anna, do we know much about the allegations that are of specific interest to this probe or that have really piqued their interest?
We haven't learned much more about that in today's media conference. In fact, we had a situation where it was said from the outset by the Prime Minister and the Defence Minister, Linda Reynolds, that these would not be issues they'll be delving into in detail because we'll be seeing a redacted form of the actual report next week. But this has certainly been a laying of the groundwork for what is going to be a very confronting document, according to these leaders of our country, in terms of its substance. And in particular, the Prime Minister said that people who are part of the defence community are going to find it very difficult to deal with once this information is publicly released. So I think that foreshadows something very troubling that will be contained within it.
Yes, and now on another matter, the Prime Minister has spoken to the US President-elect Joe Biden this morning. What do we know of what they spoke about?
Well, we first had the Prime Minister put forward a Facebook post confirming that he had spoken to the US President-elect Joe Biden to congratulate him on his victory. We now also have a readout from the US to give us some sense of how this has been taken from Joe Biden's end. Apparently, and according to this statement, it was a discussion about a close working relationship and many common challenges. In particular, according to this statement, the COVID-19 pandemic, guarding against future global health threats and confronting climate change, as well as laying the groundwork for a global economic recovery. So interesting that those are the points of discussion there, and that will play into the more localised political debate about Australia's climate change targets and policies and how Australia and the US align under the leadership of Joe Biden when he takes office.
Our political reporter in Canberra, Anna Henderson, thank you. Well, let's head to the United States now. And as the post-election wrangling continues, the surge in coronavirus case numbers is prompting more jurisdictions to reimpose restrictions. Health officials are warning the United States is on track to record more than 10 million COVID-19 infections, with the death toll possibly reaching 400,000 by February. That'd be almost double the current toll of 200,000. 140,000. But for the moment, the national focus is still on the disputed election, with Georgia announcing a recount of all votes by hand. Barney Porter has the story.
The president-elect Joe Biden returned to Pennsylvania today, the state that gave him the keys to the White House. This time not in celebration, but to lay a wreath at a Philadelphia War Memorial on Veterans Day to honour the service and sacrifice of members of the US military. The president-elect and his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, both wore masks. 230 kilometres or so down the highway, the president, Donald Trump, made his first public appearance in several days at a similar service at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia. He didn't wear a mask. He's been spending his time holed up at the White House, tweeting angry yet thus far baseless claims of voter fraud after his election loss. He's had a win of sorts in his campaign to overturn the result. Election officials in Georgia have ordered a recount by hand. Joe Biden currently leads Donald Trump by about 14,000 votes out of nearly 5 million counted.
With the margin being so close, it will require a full by-hand recount in each county. It will be a heavy lift, but we will work with the counties to get this done in time for our state certification.
Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, says the process is likely to continue right up until the deadline for certification on November the 20th. But Georgia's only worth 16 Electoral College votes to the winner, so if the state eventually does go to President Trump, it's not enough to take his current tally of 217 past Joe Biden's total of 290. In the meantime, there's this prediction from Jarbas Barbosa, the assistant director of the Pan-American Health Organization.
The U.S. continues to report record-breaking numbers of COVID-19 cases, and we expect it will soon surpass 10 million COVID-19 infections.
Wisconsin's Democrat governor, Tony Evers, gets it. He's renewed his plea for people to stay home in an unusual primetime speech just hours after his state set new records for infections and deaths.
Since last Friday, we've added more than 25,000 new cases. It took us 7.5 months to get to 100,000 cases, but it only took 36 days to add another 100,000.
Perhaps even more significantly, the Republican governor of Indiana, Eric Holcomb, has reinstated crowd limits and extended the statewide mask mandate after several weeks of sharp increases in hospitalizations and deaths.
Unfortunately, too many of us and around the country have let our guards down and either assumed we won't get it, or if we do, so be it, we'll get through it without any more universal consideration to what these multiplying numbers have on others and our system of care.
In the meantime, as the excitement over Pfizer's announcement of a vaccine dies down, there's more sage advice from the WHO. This time courtesy of Dr. Kate O'Brien, the director of the Department of Immunization, Vaccines and Biologicals.
All of those things are not going to just magically disappear like that with a vaccine. We're really going to have to crush this virus by using everything that we have at hand, and certainly not taking our foot off the pedal at any point yet.
The WHO's Dr. Kate O'Brien ending Barney Porter's report. Charles Stewart III is a professor of political science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. For more on the election, I spoke to him earlier. Professor Stewart, first off, can you update us on President Trump's latest challenges to the election result?
Well, the primary challenges that he's footing are a series of lawsuits that he's filed in the states of Michigan and in Pennsylvania, most notably. These are kind of long involved lawsuits alleging all sorts of general fraud and misconduct in the elections. None of them has a particularly strong empirical base or factual base to them, and so we'll have to see what happens once and if they go to trial. But I mean, the real news today was that the state of Georgia is going to begin a very detailed hand recount of all the ballots in that state, and they're going to begin it as soon as possible. You know, so I think this will be a situation that the nation is going to be watching because, you know, this will be what a recount looks like. And, you know, it'll either go smoothly or there will be hiccups. In that case, we'll kind of get a preview about what the Trump administration intends to do in these other states where they may be inclined to be even more aggressive.
How much damage do you think these efforts from President Trump are going to do to American elections and their reputation?
Well, you know, domestically, we already are seeing some public opinion polls which are suggesting that somewhere around 80% of Republicans are saying that Donald Trump is not being treated fairly in the election, and that if he loses, it will be because of fraud and unfair treatment to him. So it's already casting serious doubt on the election among Republicans.
Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, said yesterday that the world was watching and would be impressed by the way the United States is handling this election and the count. What do you think of those comments?
Well, what I would invite people to do actually is, and I've been inviting people to do this for the last several months, is don't pay attention to the rhetoric, especially to the general rhetoric of basically interested parties, but look at what's happening, you know, in the states as the ballot counting is about to occur and or is occurring and the recounting is about to begin. The consensus among experts who follow elections and election administration is that this has been an exceptionally well-run, exceptionally clean election.
The president-elect Joe Biden said yesterday that the uncertainty over the results or President Trump's refusal to concede isn't affecting his transition work at the moment. But as the days and weeks go on, will that work be hindered by this uncertainty?
It will a bit. We have to remember that Joe Biden is, you know, a seasoned politician who kind of knows everybody around the country from a policy perspective. And so a couple of weeks delay shouldn't have a huge difference. The one exception really is to be able to start to receive briefings on national security, which he's being denied right now. And so there are issues related to foreign policy where he really could find himself kind of behind the wave if he has to wait until, you know, the middle of December to start to receive those briefings.
Professor Charles Stewart from MIT. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Well, there's yet another setback in Australia's trade dispute with China today. Beijing is suspending the importation of all timber logs from Victoria. So that industry is joining seafood, wine, coal and barley on the list of products caught up in the trade tensions between the two countries. For more on this, I spoke to our reporter Gavin Coote a little earlier. Gavin, why has China imposed this ban?
Well, Sam, we're hearing that the Federal Agriculture Department has been trying to get some information and has now confirmed China has banned all exports of logs from Victoria after discovering a banned pest. Two shiploads of logs were meant to have left Portland in southwest Victoria for China this week, but they were found to have contained a live bark beetle that Beijing considers a quarantine pest. The industry has been aware of this issue for a while, and they'd been concerned that the bushfires that we experienced last summer may have meant the fumigation treatments for this pest were less effective. And the timber industry had already been caught up in some trade issues with China. We'd been hearing that log exports from Queensland were suspended a little bit over a week ago, but it's now part of a growing trend of Australian exports being held up for various reasons. We've had rock lobster, wine, coal and grain all hit by unofficial bans from China. And now it appears timber won't be spared by this.
Yes, what's the latest on how those other industries are being affected?
Well, it's interesting. In the case of the timber industry, which obviously is the latest to be caught up in this, they're working through all of these issues and it's already sent a bit of a chill effect through the industry because it's a huge sector in Victoria And the confirmation of a blanket ban across that whole state is already having consequences on the ground. Reports of staff being laid off or being put on standstill. As for some industries like grain, China isn't as crucial a market for those products. So many growers I've been speaking with and exporters are focusing on consolidating their trade with other countries in Asia, Southeastern Asian countries like Indonesia are, seen as a big market for them and seen as a bit of a buffer. But for some other industries that China remains by far the main game in town, like rock lobsters, for example, about 90% of Australia's rock lobsters are sent there and they have little room to move here. I was speaking to Kiri Tamazis. He's from the Northern Zone Rock Lobster Fishery in South Australia. He's been trying to work through custom issues with his customers in China for about the last fortnight. And in the meantime, he's told me lobster fishers, they're in limbo while they work out if there's a market for the lobsters.
The industry collectively, both across Southern Australia and Tasmania, we've basically made the decision that we're not going to fish and put product in tanks, waiting for that to be resolved. And we are being extremely responsible in basically working the problem out before we progress this any further.
So without that market, you're not fishing at all then?
We are very, very little capacity of fishing, and it's all to supply the local market and some smaller international markets. But as a whole, the fishing is probably about 10% of its capacity.
How long can that go on for?
We are hoping that this will get resolved within the month of November, but there are no guarantees, Gavin.
Kiri Tamazis from the Northern Zone Rock Lobster Fishery in South Australia, and before him, our reporter Gavin Coote. Well, the Chinese government may be cracking down on the importation of Australian products, but it seems Chinese shoppers just can't get enough of them. Consumers have snapped up more than $1 billion of Australian goods during the first 24 hours of the world's biggest shopping festival, known as Singles Day. Retail experts say the appetite for our products will see Chinese shoppers finding ways to get around the government bans, as Isabel Rowe reports.
At a massive media event in Hangzhou, China, numbers on a big screen tick over to $74 billion. It's Singles Day, the world's biggest online shopping festival, where Chinese shoppers can buy products from thousands of brands from around the world through online trader Alibaba.
Because of the outbreak, we spent less money earlier, so instead we buy some more now. We don't mind it too much.
Despite the economic downturn caused by coronavirus, Alibaba president Jiang Fan says sales have already doubled the previous record.
Since it's the first Singles Day post-epidemic, we all benefit from China's strong consumption recovery after the epidemic. We want to offer a stage, especially for small and medium business. This year's Singles Day marks the largest number of participating merchants in history.
Among the goods sold were $1 billion of Australian products, including baby formula and beauty products. Even groceries from chains like Woolworths were among the highest sellers.
Typically, our products are high quality and cheaper.
CEO of marketing company Zenith Media, Nikki Scriven, was expecting Singles Day to be a big winner for Australian goods.
And really what's driving that is growing concerns around product safety and counterfeit items. So in China has really reduced trust in Chinese products amongst the local market.
While the trade tensions between Australia and China have resulted in bans of several products, including seafood, timber, barley and wheat, Nikki Scriven says there is another way for Chinese citizens to access Australian goods. Daigu.
So they're basically purchasing agents and typically students that are studying in Australia, and they purchase on behalf of clients back in China and buy products and send them back to China, and they do that in bulk. So there's reports of some students making about $300,000 a year while studying, so it's quite a lucrative market for them.
Queensland University of Technology retail professor Gary Mortimer agrees Daigu is a way around trade bans for the retail sector.
We've got a population of a billion people in China, over a growing and burgeoning middle class that demand premium quality products, and a segment of Chinese consumers that will seek alternative ways around avoiding these sort of barriers or tariffs or trade restrictions to get hold of that product. I genuinely think that the Chinese population's desire for Australian-made products and Australian types of products will overcome to some extent some of those barriers.
But it's going to be harder for products like seafood and grains, things China would normally buy in bulk.
If the Chinese government was hypothetically to put a 20% excise on Australian seafood, we're talking about millions and millions of dollars of extra cost for that product to go in and enter that country. And that then puts, inhibitive costs for, say, a Chinese restaurant that might sell us Australian seafood or Australian beef.
Australian brands were the fourth most popular overseas products bought in Singles Day sales, following Japan, the United States and South Korea.
Isabel Rowe reporting. Now to the controversial tax that lobby groups and drivers fear will discourage people from opting for an electric car. The South Australian government wants to charge electric vehicle drivers for using the road so as to even the field with other motorists who are paying the fuel excise. But the move is angering clean and green advocates who argue the tax is unfair. Here's Caroline Winter.
Simon Hackett is a self-confessed lover of electric cars.
I was first hooked on them by being handed the keys to one in California in the mid-90s, and they're just a better driving experience. The fact that by side effect they're also a fabulous weapon to lower the carbon footprint of the world is actually a realisation that came to me a bit later than that.
The Australian tech entrepreneur was quick to jump on the bandwagon, bringing the first Tesla into Australia and his hometown of Adelaide 11 years ago. He's watched the market grow since then, but says there's a long way to go.
Every other developed country in the world has active incentives to own them. Australia is distinguished by being the developed country that actually only has active disincentives for them.
Electric car sales make up around 0.6% of total new vehicles sold in Australia each year, compared to 2% in places like the United States. Drivers there also get thousands of dollars off the sticker price thanks to federal and state subsidies. So the South Australian government's plan this week to slap a road user charge on EV drivers has not gone down well. Bahia Jafari is the CEO of the Electric Vehicle Council.
Electric vehicles today as a new technology carry a price premium. They're usually $15,000 to $20,000 more expensive than a comparable petrol or diesel vehicle. And so things like stamp duty, GST, all the taxes that apply when you buy a vehicle, electric vehicles actually pay more in tax today than a petrol or diesel one with fuel excise included.
He says the proposal flies in the face of what governments are trying to achieve in encouraging people to buy electric cars.
They want to reach net zero emissions by 2050. Well, that means getting rid of petrol and diesel vehicles from your roads. So you can't do that while at the same time at this very early stage when there are very few people driving vehicles, tax them, because that's going to turn people off.
While the South Australian Treasurer hasn't yet revealed the cost of the EV tax, it will include an upfront cost and an additional charge on distance travelled. It's initially expected to reap $1 million a year for the state, with other states likely to follow suit. Simon Hackett says he's not against a fee, but argues now is not the time, and he's suggested a different tact.
My challenge back to the state government is to think even further forward than that. If the concept of distance-based tax to maintain roads is reasonable, how about you do it for all cars rather than just doing it for EVs?
In the US, a distance-based tax exists on petrol and diesel cars, while around 20 states charge a flat fee for electric car drivers of anywhere between $50 and $200 annually. David Hart is director for the Centre of Science, Technology and Innovation Policy at George Mason University in Virginia.
I think it makes sense for EV drivers to pay their fair share of the benefits that they get from the infrastructure that they're driving on. At the same time, I think the benefits that they provide for the climate should be recognized as well. And that may be through some other system than the tax system.
And even if the market isn't at a particular saturation point, is it fair to start that as early as possible, do you think?
That's a good question. There's certainly a need to incentivize these vehicles when they're early in their adoption. And so any kind of fee slows things down a little bit. On the other hand, I think you want EV owners to be used to the idea that they have some costs as well, in addition to the private costs that they're paying you know, to own the vehicle, but it shouldn't be out of proportion to what the actual cost is.
David Hart, the Director of the Centre for Science, Technology and Innovation Policy at George Mason University in the United States. He was speaking to Caroline Winter. And that's The World Today for this Thursday. I'm Samantha Donovan. Hope you have a great afternoon.
Hi, I'm Angela Boispier.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. 500,000 Australians, including two former prime ministers, want to see a royal commission into Rupert Murdoch's News Corp and whether or not it's damaging to our democracy.
They're serious charges, and 500,000 is a lot of people. So could it happen? And if it did, what would it actually achieve? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.